But before I turn things over to David Griffin, let me say a few words about the main sponsor of tonight's talk, Mujkanet, the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth. That's on the web at mujka.com. That's M-U-J-C-A. I know it's ugly. I apologize and take full responsibility, but it's M-U-J-C-A, Mujka. I don't know what language that sounds like it comes from, but I don't know if I want to learn it. In any case, the Muslim Jewish Christian Alliance for 9/11 Truth wants Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and everybody else who wants the monotheists to stop killing each other, to sit down together and look at the facts of 9/11. Whoever was responsible for that crime, it is clear they intended to sow seeds of hatred and violence between the Abrahamic faith traditions. We aim to put an end to that hatred and violence. It is my pleasure here tonight to welcome a man whose work on process theology, interfaith dialogue, and especially 9/11 truth represents a truly historic contribution to this cause. Ladies and gentlemen, David Ray Griffin.
It's my first time to University of Wisconsin-Madison. I've always heard this is an extraordinary place, but now I see it's like that town in a neighboring state here where everybody is good-looking and far above average. The title of my talk tonight is 9/11 and the American Empire. How should religious people respond? I will begin by unpacking those three terms, 9/11, American Empire, and religious people, starting with the third. Although I am a Christian theologian, I am in this talk addressing religious people in general. I am doing so because I believe that religious people should respond to 9/11 and the American Empire in a particular way because of the moral principles of their religious tradition that are common to all the historic religious traditions. I have in mind principles such as, thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's oil. Thou shalt not murder thy neighbors in order to steal their oil. Thou shalt not bear false witness against thy neighbors, accusing them of illicitly harboring weapons of mass destruction in order to justify killing them to steal their oil. This language is, of course, language that we associate with the Abrahamic traditions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. But the same basic ideas can be found in other religious traditions. I turn now to the term American Empire, which has been a highly contentious term. In his 2002 book, American Empire, Andrew Bacevich points out that it was long a cherished American tradition that the United States is not and cannot be an empire. The words American Empire, he adds, were fighting words, so that uttering them was almost a sure sign that one was a left-wing critic of American foreign policy. But as Bacevich also points out, this has all recently changed, so that now even right-wing commentators freely acknowledge the existence of the American Empire. As columnist Charles Krauthammer said in 2002, people are coming out of the closet on the word empire. This new frankness often includes an element of pride, as exemplified by Krauthammer's statement that America is no mere international citizen, but the dominant power in the world, more dominant than any since Rome. Given this consensus about the reality of the American empire, the only remaining matter of debate concerns its nature. The new frankness about the American empire by conservatives is generally accompanied by portrayals of it as benign. Robert Kagan has written of the benevolent empire. Dinesh D'Souza, after writing in 2002 that America has become an empire, added that happily, it is the most magnanimous imperial power ever. Krauthammer says, the fact that America's claim to be being a benign power is not mere self-congratulation, is shown by its track record. Commentators from the left, however, have a radically different view. A recent book by Noam Chomsky is subtitled America's Quest for Global Dominance. Richard Falk has written of the Bush administration's global domination project, which poses the threat, he says, of global fascism. Chalmers Johnson was once a conservative who believed that American foreign policy aimed at promoting freedom and democracy. But he now describes the United States as a military juggernaut intent on world domination. Andrew Bacevich is another conservative who has recently changed his mind. Unlike Johnson, he has not come to identify with the left. But he has come to agree with its assessment of the American empire. He now ridicules the claim that the promotion of peace, democracy, and human rights, and the punishment of evildoers, not the pursuit of self-interest, has defined the essence of American diplomacy. Pointing out that the aim of the U.S. military has been to achieve something approaching omnipotence, Bacevich mocks the idea that such power in America's hands is by definition benign. If the American empire is interpreted in different ways, the same is true all the more so for the term 9/11. For those Americans who accept the official interpretation, 9/11 was a surprise attack on the U.S. government and its people by Islamic terrorists. For some Americans, 9/11 has a more complex meaning. This second group, while accepting the official interpretation of the attacks, thinks of 9/11 primarily as an event that was used opportunistically by the Bush administration to extend the American empire. This interpretation is effectively presented by writers such as Noam Chomsky, Rahul Mahajan, and Chalmers Johnson. For a third group of Americans, the name 9/11 connotes an event with a more sinister dimension. These citizens believe that the Bush administration knew the attacks were coming and intentionally let them happen. Although no national poll has been taken to ascertain how many Americans in general hold this view, a Zogby poll in New York surprisingly indicated that almost half of the residents of New York City held that view. According to a fourth view of 9/11, the attacks were not merely foreknown by the Bush administration. They were orchestrated by it. Although thus far no poll has tried to find out how many Americans hold this view, polls in Canada and Germany taken some time back indicated that this view was already held by 15 to 20% of their people. Religious people who take the moral principles of their religious tradition seriously will probably have very different attitudes about the American empire, depending on which of these four views they hold. If they accept the official view, according to which America was the innocent victim of evil terrorists, then it is easy for them to think of America's so-called war on terror as a just war. This is the position taken by Jean Bethke Elstein, a professor of ethics at the University of Chicago's Divinity School, in a book called Just War Against Terror. From this perspective, the war on terror has nothing to do with imperial designs. It is simply a war to save the world from evil terrorists. Second interpretation of 9/11, according to which the Bush administration cynically exploited the 9/11 attacks to further its imperial plans, has quite different implications. Although it thinks of the attacks as surprise attacks, planned entirely by external enemies of America, it regards these attacks as blowback for injustices perpetrated by U.S. imperialism. This second view typically regards the American response to the attacks of 9/11 as far worse than the attacks themselves. They've already led to hundreds of thousands of deaths. This interpretation of 9/11 would lead people who take their religion's moral principles seriously to support a movement to change U.S. foreign policy. An even stronger reaction would be evoked by the third interpretation, for it entails that the Bush administration allowed thousands of its own citizens to be killed on 9/11, deliberately and cold-bloodedly, for the sake of advancing its imperial interests, and then use this event as an excuse to kill hundreds of thousands of people in other lands, while hypocritically portraying itself as promoting a culture of life. Of course, those who accept the previous interpretation know that hypocrisy with regard to the sanctity of life has long been a feature of official U.S. rhetoric. And yet most Americans, if they learned that their government had deliberately let their own citizens be killed, would surely consider this betrayal qualitatively different. For this would be treason, a betrayal of the oath taken by American political leaders to protect their own citizens. If this third view implies that the Bush administration is guilty of a heinous and even treasonous crime, this is all the more the case with the fourth view. For many Americans, the idea that we are living in a country whose own leaders planned and carried out the attacks of 9/11 is simply too horrible to entertain. Unfortunately, however, there is considerable evidence for this view. And if we find this evidence convincing, the implications for resistance to the U.S. empire building project are radical. As Basevich has emphasized, the only remaining debate about the American empire is whether it is benign. The interpretation of 9/11 is relevant to this debate, because it would be very difficult to accept either the third or the fourth interpretation and still consider American imperialism benign. So I now turn to some of the evidence that supports these views. I will look first at evidence that supports at least the third view, according to which U.S. officials had foreknowledge of the attacks. A central aspect of the official story about 9/11 is that the attacks were planned entirely by Al-Qaeda, with no one else knowing the plans. A year after the attacks, FBI Director Robert Mueller said, "To this day, we have found no one in the United States except the actual hijackers who knew of the plot." Since that time, federal officials have had to admit that they had received far more warnings prior to 9/11 than they had previously acknowledged. But these admissions, while raising the question of why further safety measures were not in place, do not necessarily show that the federal officials had specific foreknowledge of the attacks. One could still, as the 9/11 Commission did, accept the conclusion published at the end of the 2002 Congressional Joint Inquiries Report, which said that none of the intelligence gathered by the U.S. intelligence community identified the time, place, and specific nature of the attacks that were planned for September 11, 2001. Unfortunately for the official account, however, there are reports indicating that federal officials did have that very specific kind of information. I will give two examples. The first example involves Attorney David Shippers, who had been the chief prosecutor for the impeachment of President Clinton. 2 days after 9/11, Shippers declared that he had received warnings from FBI agents about the attacks 6 weeks earlier, warnings that included both the dates and the targets. These agents had come to him, Shippers said, because FBI headquarters had blocked their investigations and had threatened them with prosecution if they went public with their information. So they asked Shippers to use his influence to get the government to take action to prevent the attacks. And Shippers, surely, as the prosecutor of Clinton, should have had influence in Republican circles. And yet he reports that he tried to contact Attorney General Ashcroft, and Ashcroft repeatedly refused to return his calls. Shippers' allegations about the FBI agents were then corroborated in a story by William Norman Grigg called Did We Know What Was Coming?, which was published in The New American, a conservative magazine. According to Grigg, the three FBI agents he interviewed told him that the information provided to Shippers was widely known within the FBI before September 11th. If Shippers, Grigg, and these agents are telling the truth, it would seem that when FBI Director Mueller claimed that the FBI had found no one in this country with advanced knowledge of the plot, he was not telling the truth. The government also would have had foreknowledge of the attacks because of an extraordinarily high volume of put options purchased in the 3 days before 9/11. To buy put options for a particular company is to bet that its stock price is going to go down. These purchases were for two and only two airlines, American and United, the two airlines whose planes were used in the attacks, and also for Morgan Stanley Dean Witter, which occupied 22 stories of the World Trade Center. The price of these shares did, of course, plummet after 9/11. As the San Francisco Chronicle said, these unusual purchases, which resulted in profits of at least tens of millions of dollars, raised suspicions that the investors had advanced knowledge of the strikes. For our purposes, the most important implication of this story follows from the fact that U.S. intelligence agencies monitor the market, looking for signs of imminent untoward events. These extraordinary purchases, therefore, would have suggested to intelligence agencies that in the next few days, United and American airliners were going to be used in attacks on the World Trade Center. That is fairly specific knowledge. These two examples then imply the falsity of the joint inquiry statement that none of the intelligence gathered by the U.S. intelligence community identified the time, place, and specific nature of the attacks. Indeed, one of the FBI agents interviewed by William Grigg said, "Obviously, people had to know. It's terrible to think this, but this must have been allowed to happen, as part of some other agenda. He was right. This would be terrible. There is considerable evidence, however, that the full truth is even more terrible, that the reason some officials had foreknowledge of the attacks is because they had planned them. The evidence for this fourth view consists of features of the attacks in conjunction with behavior of U.S. officials that cannot be explained on the assumption that the attacks were planned and executed entirely by foreign agents. I will give four examples. One feature of the attacks that suggests complicity by U.S. officials is the twofold fact that the U.S. military failed to stop the attacks on 9/11, and that then, since then, they have given us three different stories as to why they failed. These changing stories suggest that the military has been trying to cover up the fact that a stand-down order was given on 9/11, canceling the military's own standard operating procedures for dealing with hijacked airplanes. It is certainly clear that some agency, either the military or the FAA, failed to follow standard procedures on 9/11. When these procedures are followed, the FAA, as soon as it sees signs that a plane may have been hijacked, calls military officials, who then call the nearest Air Force base with fighters on alert, telling it to send up a couple of fighters to intercept the plane. Such interceptions usually occur within 10 to 20 minutes after the first sign of trouble. This is a routine procedure happening about 100 times a year. If you've read the story in Popular Mechanics, you know, one of their big lies is, oh, gee, there's only been one such interception in the last several years. No, it's a routine procedure about 100 times a year. On 9/11, however, it did not happen. Why not? The military's first story was that no planes were sent up until after the Pentagon was hit. The military leaders were admitting, therefore, that they had left their fighters on the ground for almost 90 minutes after the FAA had first noticed signs of a possible hijacking. This first story suggested to many people that a stand-down order must have been given. By the end of the week, the military had put out a second story, saying that it had sent up fighters, but that because the FAA had been very late in notifying it about the hijackings, the fighters arrived too late in each case. One problem with this story is if the FAA personnel had responded so slowly, heads should have rolled, but none did. An even more serious problem is that even assuming the truth of the late notification times, the military's fighters still had time to intercept the hijacked airliners before they were to hit their targets. The second story implied, therefore, that standard procedures had been violated by the military as well as by the FAA. To try to defend the military against this accusation, the 9/11 Commission report gave us a third story, according to which the FAA, after giving the military insufficient warning about the first hijacked airline, gave it absolutely no warning about the other three until after they had crashed. But as I have pointed out in my second book on 9/11, the 9/11 Commission Report, Omissions and Distortions, this account is wholly implausible. Besides portraying the FAA personnel from top to bottom as incompetent, bumbling dolts, the 9/11 Commission's account rests on claims that contradict many credible and mutually supporting testimonies. In some of these cases, the fact that the Commission is simply lying is obvious. In addition, this third story implies that the military's second story, which it had been telling for almost 3 years, was almost entirely false. So if our military leaders were lying to us all that time, why should we believe them now? And if our military is lying to us, must we not assume that it is doing so to cover up its own guilt? In sum, the behavior of the military, both on 9/11 and afterwards, combined with the fact that the 9/11 Commission had to resort to lies to make the U.S. military appear blameless, suggests that U.S. military leaders were complicit in the attacks. A similar conclusion follows from an examination of the attacks on the Pentagon. One of the debates about this attack is whether the Pentagon was hit by American Airlines Flight 77, as the official account says, or by military aircraft. Either story, however, implies that the attack was, at least partly, an inside job. If we assume that the Pentagon was struck by Flight 77, we must ask, how could this have occurred? The Pentagon is surely the best defended structure on the face of the planet for three reasons. First, it is only a few miles from Andrews Air Force Base, which has at least three squadrons of fighter jets on alert at all times to protect the nation's capital. Of course, part of the official story is that Andrews was not keeping any fighters on alert. But as I think I showed convincingly in my book, this story is completely implausible. The second reason the Pentagon is so well defended is that the U.S. military has the best radar systems in the world. One of its systems, it has bragged, does not miss anything occurring in North American airspace. This system is also said to be capable of monitoring a great number of airborne attack objects simultaneously, such as would be necessary in the case of a massive missile attack. Given that capability, the official story, according to which Flight 77 flew toward the Pentagon undetected for 40 minutes, is absurd. Any unauthorized airplane coming towards the Pentagon would have been detected and intercepted long before it got close. Third, the Pentagon is ringed by anti-missile batteries, which are programmed to destroy any aircraft entering the Pentagon's airspace, except for any aircraft with a U.S. military transponder that would radiate a friendly signal. If, by some fluke, Flight 77 had entered the Pentagon's airspace, it could have escaped being shot down only if officials in the Pentagon had deactivated the anti-aircraft system. So even if we accept the official story, according to which the Pentagon was hit by Flight 77 under the control of Al-Qaeda hijackers, we must conclude that the attack succeeded only because the Pentagon wanted it to succeed. But there are many reasons to reject the official story. First, the alleged pilot, Hani Hanjour, was widely known as a terrible pilot who could not possibly have flown the trajectory of the aircraft that hit the Pentagon. Second, this aircraft hit the Pentagon's west wing, which would have been the least likely spot for terrorists with any intelligence whatsoever, and these guys were supposed to be so bright, they out-tricked our whole Air Force defense system. They would not have chosen the west wing. Why? Well, in the first place, as I already indicated, to hit the west wing, the aircraft had to execute a very complex maneuver, which even some experienced pilots would probably have trouble doing with that size of an airliner. Second, the West Wing was being renovated. So instead of having thousands of people in it who would have been killed, it only had a few hundred. And most of them were not military people, they were civilians working on the renovation. Thirdly, you would think the terrorists, if they hate America and they wanted to strike at the Pentagon, the symbol of American military strike, they would have wanted to kill as many of the top brass and Donald Rumsfeld himself. They're over in the East Wing, as far as you could be away from the West Wing. Finally, the West Wing had been, the renovation involved a great reinforcement. So the damage was much less to the West Wing than it would have been any other part of the building. Another problem with the official story is that the initial damage to the West Wing's facade was far too minimal to have been caused by the impact of a Boeing 757. Fourth, photographs and eyewitnesses in the immediate aftermath failed to provide unambiguous evidence of the remains of a Boeing 757. Fifth, there are videos that would show whether the aircraft that struck the Pentagon was, in fact, a Boeing 757. But the FBI confiscated these videos within minutes after the attacks, and now the authorities have refused to release them. Sixth, the fact that the aircraft was not shot down by the Pentagon's anti-aircraft defense system suggests that it belonged to the U.S. military. So, whether or not the Pentagon was hit by Flight 77, the evidence suggests it must have been an inside job. We can conclude the same thing about the attacks on the World Trade Center. Why? Because the collapses of the Twin Towers and Building Number 7 had to have been examples of controlled demolition, brought about by thousands of explosives placed throughout each of the buildings. No foreign terrorists could have obtained the kind of access to the buildings this would have required. One reason for concluding that the three buildings were brought down by explosive is the very fact that they did collapse. High-rise steel frame buildings have never, before or after 9/11, been caused to collapse by fire. Even when, as in the Philadelphia fire of 1999 and the Madrid fire of February of this year, the fires were much larger, much hotter, and much longer lasting than any of the fires in the World Trade Center. The second reason is the specific nature of the collapses, each feature of which points to explosives. For example, the buildings collapsed straight down and at virtually free fall speed, as in controlled demolitions. And then the rubble smoldered for months afterwards. With regard to the Twin Towers in particular, many people in the building said that they saw, they felt, or heard explosions. Virtually all the concrete of these enormous structures was pulverized into very fine dust. Try this. Get a piece of concrete and drop it a little over 1,000 feet and see if it pulverizes into very fine dust. It won't happen. Much of this dust, along with steel and aluminum, was blown out horizontally from the buildings several hundred feet. Most of the steel beams and columns came down in sections about 30 feet long, conveniently ready to be loaded onto trucks. And pools of molten steel were found beneath the rubble. These and even more effects point to the existence of very powerful, precisely placed explosives. A third thing supporting the theory of controlled demolitions is evidence of a deliberate cover-up. If the building's steel columns and beams had indeed been broken by explosives, an examination of the steel would have revealed this fact. However, although it is normally a federal offense to remove anything from a crime scene, the steel was quickly loaded onto trucks and put on ships headed for Asia to be melted down. I will mention one more example of the cover-up. Insofar as there is an official story as to why the towers collapsed, it is the pancake theory, according to which the floors above the destruction caused by the airplanes collapsed on the floor below, and then those floors collapsed on the floor below that, and then it pancaked all the way down. Now, even if this theory were remotely plausible, can you imagine it pancaking at free fall speed? The other problem is, what happened to the 47 massive steel columns that constituted the core of each of these twin towers? They were the weight-bearing structures of each tower. Those 47, even if the pancake theory were true, those 47 steel beams should have been sticking up at least several hundred feet into the air, just like the old phonographs, where sometimes the 78 records would collapse, but the spindles still sticking up in the air. You should have had 47 spindles still sticking up in the air. Well, what did the 9/11 Commission report do about that problem? It avoided the problem incredibly by simply denying the existence of these columns, even though those columns, I'm not making this up. These columns were the unique feature of these towers when they were first built. So the commission report, after saying falsely that most of the weight of each tower was borne by the steel columns in its exterior walls, this supposedly authoritative report said the interior core of the buildings was a hollow steel shaft in which elevators and stairwells were grouped. Such a desperate lie is a sure sign of a cover-up. In any case, when we look at all these features of the collapses, the idea that they could have been caused by the impact of the airplanes plus the resulting fires is ridiculous. This is even clearer with regard to building number 7, which wasn't hit by any airplane, and yet it came down about 5:30 that afternoon. Its collapse remains so impossible to explain, except as controlled demolition, that the 9/11 Commission report did not even mention it, as if the collapse of a 47-story building was not worthy of comment. And it only had fires on floors number 7 and 12 of 47 stories. In sum, the collapses and the cover-up, like the strike on the Pentagon, the military's failure to prevent the attacks, and its ever-changing stories, show that the attacks must have been planned and executed by our own political and military leaders. The same conclusion can be inferred from the behavior of the Secret Service agents with the president that morning. As everyone who saw Michael Moore's Fahrenheit 9/11 knows, President Bush was in a second grade classroom that morning in Florida when he was informed about the second strike on the World Trade Center. The first strike he dismissed as a horrible accident, a bad pilot. But with the second one, it was clear America was under an unprecedented terrorist attack. And yet the president simply sat there. Many people have asked why he did not spring into action, assuming his role as commander-in-chief. But the real question, which Michael Moore mentioned in passing, It's why the Secret Service did not immediately rush him away to a safe place. Bush's location had been highly publicized, and if the attacks were a complete surprise, executed solely by foreign terrorists, the Secret Service agents would have had no idea how many planes had been hijacked. They would have had to assume that the president himself might be the target of one of the attacks. For all they would have known, a hijacked airliner might have been heading towards them at that very moment, ready to crash into the school and kill the president and everyone else. And yet these agents, who are highly trained to respond instantly in such situations, allowed the president to remain in the classroom another 10 minutes. They then allowed him to remain at the school to give his regularly scheduled TV address to the nation. This behavior makes sense only if the head of the Secret Service detail knew that the planned attacks did not include an attack on the president. And how could they know this for certain unless the attacks were being carried out by people within our own government? Although many more examples could be given, these four are sufficient to suggest that there is no escape from the frightening conclusion that 9/11 was engineered by the Bush administration and its Pentagon. As to why they would do this, at least part of the answer is clear from the way in which they have used 9/11 to advance the American empire. Immediately after 9/11, in fact, members of the Bush administration repeatedly referred to the attacks as an opportunity. In the words of Donald Rumsfeld, an opportunity to refashion the world. Seeing this connection between 9/11 and the American empire can be a stimulus to face up fully to the awful truth about this empire. To be sure, as Chomsky, Falk, and Chalmers Johnson illustrate, very strong portrayals of American empire imperialism as far from benign can be drawn without any suggestion that the Bush administration arranged 9/11. These portrayals can be drawn from publicly available documents. One such document is the National Security Strategy of the United States of America, published by the Bush administration in September of 2002. David North says, not unfairly, that this document asserts as the guiding policy of the United States the right to use military force against any country it believes to be or believes at some point may become a threat to American interests. No other country in modern history, adds North, has asserted such a sweeping claim to world domination. Another such document, called Vision for 2020, was published in February of 1997 by the U.S. Space Command. The mission statement at the head of this document reads, U.S. Space Command dominating the space dimension of military operations to protect U.S. interests and investments. Nothing about freedom, democracy, and human rights. In the body of the document, in fact, we find this amazingly candid statement. The globalization of the world economy will continue with a widening between haves and have-nots. The point of this statement is that as the domination of the world economy by the United States and its allies increases, the world's poor will get still poorer, making the have-nots hate America all the more. We will need, therefore, the power to keep them in line. The United States can do this, and this is the document's main message, through full spectrum dominance, which will involve merging space superiority with land, sea, and air superiority. Dominance in space will include, the document frankly says, the power to deny others the use of space. By speaking only of the Space Command's effort to develop a missile defense system, the Pentagon and the White House like to suggest that its purpose is purely defensive. But the goal includes weaponizing space so as to give U.S. forces, in the words of a more recent document, a prompt global strike capability, whether nuclear or non-nuclear, that will allow the U.S. to rapidly and accurately strike distant targets. The fact that the U.S. Space Command's program is an aggressive one is announced in the logo of one of its divisions, In Your Face from Outer Space. Simply from these and other documents, taken in conjunction with the actions of the Bush administration and the U.S. military, we can see through the claim that the U.S. project of creating the first truly global empire is a benevolent or even benign enterprise. However, we can fully grasp the extent to which this project is propelled by fanaticism based on a deeply perverted value system only when we realize that the terrorist attacks of 9/11 were orchestrated by our own leaders, and that they did this to provide the justification, the fear, and the funding for the so-called war on terror, which would be used as a pretext for enlarging the empire. I will illustrate this point with one of the most brazen examples of the use of 9/11 to get funding. Shortly before the current Bush administration took office, about a year before, a document entitled Rebuilding America's Defenses was published by an organization called the Project for the New American Century, founding members of which included Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, and Donald Rumsfeld. This document focused primarily on getting more tax monies allocated for the technological transformation of the U.S. military, with the centerpiece of this technological transformation being the U.S. Space Command's project to weaponize and thereby control space. Because this transformation of the U.S. military will be very expensive, the document said, it will probably proceed very slowly unless America suffers some catastrophic and catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor. It is interesting that then on the night of 9/11 itself, President Bush reportedly wrote in his diary, the Pearl Harbor of the 21st century took place today. In any case, earlier that evening, Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld was on message. We might assume he would have been disoriented by the fact that the Pentagon had just, under his watch, suffered an unprecedented attack. Instead, he was ready to use the attacks to obtain more money for the U.S. Space Command. He had before taking office, in fact, chaired the commission about the U.S. Space Command, popularly known as the Rumsfeld Commission. That evening of 9/11 itself, in front of television cameras, Rumsfeld berated Senator Carl Levin, then chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, saying, Senator Levin, you and other Democrats in the Congress have voiced fear that you simply don't have enough money for the large increases in defense that the Pentagon is seeking, especially for missile defense. Does this sort of thing convince you that an emergency exists in this country to increase defense spending? The strategy worked. Congress immediately appropriated an additional $40 billion for the Pentagon. Since then, furthermore, the president has gotten every additional appropriation he has sought for the so-called war on terror. Besides being a rousing success in obtaining increased spending for military purposes, 9/11 also provided the pretext for putting many military bases in Central Asia. Zbigniew Brzezinski, in his 1997 book, The Grand Chessboard, had said that doing so would be crucial for maintaining American primacy, partly because of the huge oil reserves around the Caspian Sea. Indeed, the project for the new American century may have gotten its idea that a new Pearl Harbor would be helpful from this book. Brzezinski, explaining that the American public had supported America's engagement in World War II largely because of the shock effect of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor, suggested that Americans today would support the needed military operations in Central Asia only in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. And indeed, thanks to the attacks of 9/11, the Bush administration was able to carry out its plans to attack Afghanistan, a plan that we now know had been formulated several months before 9/11. The White House now has a friendly government in Afghanistan, and the Pentagon has military bases there and in several of the other countries in Central Asia. We also know that the intention to invade Iraq existed long before 9/11, and that this intention was based on imperial designs not discussed with Saddam's wickedness. In the Project for the New American Century's 2000 document, we read, "While the unresolved conflict with Iraq provides the immediate justification, the need for a substantial American force presence in the Gulf transcends the issue of the regime of Saddam Hussein." The U.S. military is now intending to build several permanent bases in Iraq, which has the world's second largest known supply of oil reserves. The attacks of 9/11 again provided the pretext, as the Bush administration deceived a majority of the American people into believing that Saddam was connected with Osama bin Laden and even directly responsible for the attacks of 9/11. I suggested earlier that seeing the true connections between 9/11 and the Global Domination Project helps us understand how fully this project reflects fanaticism based on a deeply perverted value system. This is a value system that is diametrically opposed to the value systems on which all the great religious and moral traditions of the world have been based. These traditional value systems say that we should not covet, steal, and murder, that we should make sure that everyone has the necessary means for a decent life. But our government's project for global domination is carried out in the name of the haves of the world who want still more, even if it means killing hundreds of thousands of people and letting millions more die every year because of starvation and other poverty-related diseases. We can now see furthermore that some political and military leaders are so fanatically infected with these perverted values that they are willing to kill thousands of their own citizens, then endlessly use a deceptive account of these terrorist attacks to justify a war on terror, in the name of which they claim the right to do virtually anything they wish, ignoring all principles of international law and morality. I turn now, finally, to the question, how should religious people respond to 9/11 and the American Empire? My discussion of this question must be very brief, consisting merely of four suggestions. First, discover and then speak the truth. I would suggest that religious people should, if they have not done so already, study about both 9/11 and the American Empire to see if they find the claims I have made here true. If they do, then they should do everything they can to make others aware of these facts. Second, create new means to spread the truth. It is clear that the mainstream press in America is complicit in the cover-up of the truth about the American empire in general and 9/11 in particular. For example, my second book, which exposes many outrageous lies, has not been reviewed by a single mainstream newspaper, magazine, television station, so on. There are, of course, alternative publications, both in print and on the internet, that seek to expose the truth about the American empire. Most of these, however, fail to deal with 9/11. And most of them are indifferent to or even hostile to religion. So they do not provide effective organs to communicate with religious communities. Perhaps the most important thing that religious groups concerned with getting the truth about 9/11 out could do is to create new means of communication, means through which the contrast between the values of the religious traditions and the values of the global domination project can be made clear. On this basis, an ecumenical religious movement to oppose the global domination project, partly by exposing the truth about 9/11, might be formed. Third, formulate proposals for subverting the global domination project. As such a movement begins to form, it will need to decide rather concretely how to go about trying to subvert the global domination project. Another thing we need from religious thinkers of the various traditions, therefore, are proposals for how to do this. I will soon be publishing, I hope, my own proposal, which is centered around the idea of global democracy. Other people will favor different proposals. But I stress the importance of having proposals from religious thinkers. It is probably only such proposals, drawing explicitly on the moral principles of the religious traditions, that will have the power to move large numbers of people around the world. Fourth, form alliances with other moral, non-governmental organizations, generally called NGOs. I have emphasized that it is important for representatives from the various religious traditions to join forces. Indeed, my motto is, "Religions of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your impotence." But it is essential at the same time for these religious groups to forge alliances with what we can call the other moral NGOs of the world. Whether they are working for human rights, for peace, for ecological sustainability, or some related cause, the moral principles that motivate these NGOs are diametrically opposed to the values of the Global Domination Project. By emphasizing the moral principles that we have in common, organizations that are and are not explicitly religious can join forces in opposing that radically immoral project. I will close with the observation that insofar as Americans participate in this anti-imperial movement, their activities will be deeply patriotic, because they will be seeking to call our nation back to its moral ideals, which stand our moral ideals, which stand diametrically opposed to the values implicit in the Global Domination Project. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
Okay, first one. These are pretty random, actually, because, as I said, they're all good. My 15-year-old daughter wanted to be here, but she's in the Spanish test tomorrow. Her question is, the U.S. military is running out of troops. A draft seems to be in the offing, but probably wouldn't be accepted by the people without another 9/11-type event. A WMD attack, perhaps. Do you see signs of this coming?
That is a very frightening thought coming from a 15-year-old, isn't it?
Yeah.
Knows what's going on. Because the problem is, as she suggests, if a draft is started, then we do have Vietnam. And that's what they learned. If you have a draft, then you get movements on university campuses that get a lot of publicity, and they don't want that. So they've tried using high-tech technology, but boy, when you invade and occupy, you need a lot of troops, as they learned. So they tried mercenaries, but the mercenaries from the other countries are mostly going home now, so what are we going to do? So I'm afraid she's right that the thought of another new Pearl Harbor may be an option.
Perish the thought.
Perish the thought.
Okay, next, what is your opinion of Mike Rupert's work in Crossing the Rubicon, specifically about mock fake military exercises with live fly hijacking exercises and radar inserts?
Yeah. Michael Rupert is one of the great heroes of the 9/11 movement. He was, he was there long before most everybody else was. Paul Thompson's great timeline that got me started, Paul gives Michael Rupert credit, says he got started with Michael. With regard to that particular thesis, it's one that I have not studied sufficiently to have what I would call a really informed opinion on it. It's certainly very interesting that these exercises were going on, but as exactly what role they played that morning, I'm just fairly agnostic. When it comes to Rupert's more particular thesis about Cheney being the one who was in charge that morning and calling the shots, that seems very clear. So we're clearly one on that, and I just say on the other, I think it's probably very significant, but I couldn't say anything more about it.
Okay. Next one, a common question that we conspiracy theorists hear. An inside job of this magnitude involves the conspiracy of a lot of people. How come there is no leak, nobody cracking, nothing? Thank you.
Yeah. Let me say a word about the term conspiracy theory. It's become almost an oath of being an American to say, oh, I don't believe in conspiracy theories. But, of course, your newspaper every day is filled with stories of conspiracies. Whenever two or more people get together to do something illegal or immoral, that's a conspiracy. And if you've got an idea of what happened, you have a conspiracy theory. So we all are believers in conspiracy theories. And the official story about 9/11 is the mother of all 9/11 conspiracy theories. This is the theory that these 19 Arab Muslim hijackers, without any help from anybody in the United States, out-tricked our trillion-dollar military defense system and pulled this off and knocked down these buildings. Well, the question is not whether you believe in a conspiracy theory or not, but which theory stands up to the evidence. Another thing to point out is that as James Fetzer, a philosopher of science, who is now getting involved in the 9/11 truth movement, has pointed out, theory is sometimes a very strong word. We have the theory of gravitation, relativity theory. We have quantum theory. These are very precise theories. The point is they're testable. A conspiracy theory is fine if it's testable. Well, fortunately, the government's theory is testable. You can test, can steel frame high-rise buildings fall down solely because of fire? And they've actually done experiments to try this, and they've never been able to get a building to even come close to collapsing. So it's a testable theory which has been falsified. And I've indicated several other aspects that are, I think, clear falsifications of the official theory. Now, the question, all sorts of questions can be then raised, sort of a priori questions. Well, why would they do this? And I raised some of those in my book, if you read, chapter 9 of the New Pearl Harbor. There are lots of puzzling questions. I thought the first question was going to be, you know, what happened to Barbara Olson? Then that's always the first one. I don't know. There are all of these things. And so is it possible that very many people could be involved in a conspiracy and keep it silent for a long time? Well, yes. Remember the Manhattan Project. A lot of people were involved in that, and that was kept secret for a long time. And we've looked back. Now we know that lots of previous conspiracies were kept silent for a long time. America's first attack in Indonesia, we had a full-scale war going on there. And until a book was published on it in the late 90s, hardly any Americans knew about it. It was kept secret for a very long time. If you add to the fact that we do have other instances, the fact that people, many of the people involved are government and military and other government employees who take an oath, like these FBI guys. They've taken an oath of obedience. If they violate that, see, they're hoping shippers could, I don't know what's happening now, but originally they were evidently hoping that shippers could get a trial so they could be subpoenaed, in which case they would have to testify, and that would free them from prosecution. But if they just come out and talk, then they're prosecuted, they're sent to prison for the rest of their lives maybe, they can't support their families. And then in some cases, people are told, well, you know, Joe, if you start talking about this, somebody's gonna get really mad at you, and I don't know how we're gonna protect your wife and kids. Would you talk? Particularly when there's no there's nobody asking you to come forward. Did the 9/11 Commission make a general appeal and say, please, if you've got any information on this, come and talk to us? No, nobody was invited other than government employees. And so if you go to the mainstream media, they ridicule you. So who's going to risk their family's life to come forward? So no, I am not surprised that a rather large number of people could be involved. And also, you know, we have previous examples of things that went on and people who knew got killed. How many in people who had apparently had some knowledge about JFK's assassination ended up dead? A lot of people know about that, so they know what can happen. So no, I'm not surprised. But the fact is that, nevertheless, some people are trying to come forward, these FBI agents. Sybille Edmonds has been trying to come forward and tell her story for many, many months now. As I report in my book on the 9/11 Commission report, she testified to the commission for 3.5 hours. She told them very specific things. She's since then written a public letter to, an open letter to Chairman Kaine, reminding him of what she told the commission, such as that their Iranian asset had told them that Osama bin Laden, he was an expert on Afghanistan, that Osama bin Laden was planning an attack in the United States pretty soon. The translator who got that information was told to keep quiet within the FBI. She told the FBI about that. That other translator told the FBI in his 2.5 hours of testimony. None of that appears in the 9/11 Commission report. All that you learned that Sybille Edmonds, one tiny little note says that she had some suggestions that FBI should follow its own policies a little more closely. That's all you learned from her 3.5 hours of testimony. So she has been trying to come forward, and some other people too, and they've lost their jobs. So people are.
Okay, here's a question on source validation methodology. Who are your sources, and what standards did you employ to validate these sources?
Yeah, in the New Pearl Harbor, I did rely primarily on the four sources that I cited the most. Nafiz Ahmed's book, but he relied also a lot on Paul Thompson, and also used Michel Chosudowski, the economist in Canada. Paul Thompson, one thing interesting about his timeline, and now he's published his book as the Terror Timeline, he used only mainline sources. So New York Times, Boston Globe, The Guardian, London Times, and so on. I don't even think he quoted The Nation. I mean, he really stuck to what are considered really mainline sources, and yet found hundreds of stories that contradicted the official account. As to method, you know, it's partly you just have to learn to trust your kind of educated judgment. I've gotten into a lot of previous fields. My work at the Center for Process Studies called for me to organize conferences in a lot of fields, philosophy of physics, Eastern religions, Chinese religions, Asian, Hinduism, Buddhism, political theory, economic theory. So in each case, I had to go in and start reading around and learning who were the generally considered respectable writers, and then who were the ones who maybe weren't so respectable, but were good, and had something important to say outside the mainstream, and so on. So I think method is in that sense more of a sort of trained judgment about these things. And of course, people can differ on these things, but I did, and I limited myself to stories that I found to be at least highly plausible, but I did not commit myself, as those of you have read the book, to say, I know these stories are true. I mean, there are hundreds of stories there, and a single researcher like myself or Paul Thompson, we don't have the resources. So what we're calling on is we're saying, there is a prima facie case here for a genuine investigation. We've got organizations that have the money to carry out investigations like that. They're called the U.S. Congress. They're called the U.S. media, which have billions of dollars. So the question is, what method are they using? Ignoring.
For what it's worth, David, I handed Senator Russ Feingold your book 2 weeks ago, and he promised to look into it.
I've had a lot of promises.
Yeah.
promises.
Okay,
but Russ Feingold is a good guy. I bet he'll do it. Yeah. Bet he'll do it. Yeah.
I actually urged him to take up this in hopes of a Feingold McKinney ticket next election, if there is an election. Okay, where do we go from here? How do we get through to a brainwashed electorate led by money and power?
Next question.
We invite C-SPAN.
Absolutely right. This is really a historic event. You know, when the hearings were going on, C-SPAN covered those and covered some of the discussions that occurred afterwards with some of the 9/11 families. And Kyle Hintz of 9/11 Citizens Movement was able to make a statement which C-SPAN did cover, and so that did get conveyed to the American people. But to my knowledge, maybe C-SPAN can correct me, but to my knowledge, this is the first event in which this kind of major presentation, full-hour presentation, has been made and covered. So this might be the beginning of something big. We'll see. Look about four more.
Four more questions. Okay, we've got room for four more questions at the top of the deck. Specifics. Isn't it true that CIA officials met with Osama bin Laden when he was being operated on in a hospital shortly before 9/11.
This seems to be true. It was reported by a very reputable Swiss journalist and picked up by several European newspapers, including some British newspapers, by just accidentally, I guess, by no American newspaper, but that in July of 2001, when Osama bin Laden was already the number one wanted man in the world, the report is that he went to a hospital in Dubai. The American hospital was treated by an American surgeon and visited by the local CIA agent, as well as by the head of Saudi intelligence. So it appears that this is one of the stories I tell in the New Pearl Harbor that suggests that the relationship between the Bush family and the bin Laden family isn't maybe exactly what we've been told. And of course, we have a full-length book on that, House of Bush, House of Saud. And in fact, let me say a word about that. That part of Michael Moore's movie, gosh, I'm blanking on the guy's name who wrote House of Bush, House of Saud.
Craig Unger, yeah.
I was very grateful. He corresponded with me on this. And if you remember, after the movie, when Michael Moore's movie got trashed so much by mainline critics, movie critics telling him he didn't know what he was talking about. They said that this idea that any Saudi flights were allowed to go before other flights were allowed to go was just false. And what Craig Unger had reported was that on September 13th, 2 days after 9/11, there was a flight that took some young Saudis from Tampa to Lexington. And Lexington was one of the places where a big plane was going to take a number of them, bin Ladens and other Saudis out of the country. And Craig Unger stressed that this flight left before private flights were allowed to go in the United States. Now, he emphasized that at 11 o'clock that morning, American airspace was open to commercial planes, but not to private. And there was a special notice sent out that says this is only for commercial flights. If any private flights go up, they will be forced down. Nevertheless, that flight went at 4:30 that afternoon and was not forced down. They had permission to go. Now, the 9/11 Commission poo-poos that story and says, oh, there was no problem because American airspace was opened at 11 o'clock, deliberately ignoring the distinction Craig Unger made very explicitly, both in his book and in, I think it was a Wall Street Journal article, the distinction between commercial and private flights. So Michael Moore was right. Craig Unger was right on that.
Short of outright illegal disclosures, will it ever prove possible to create a culture of accountability and transparency with respect to the so-called intelligence community?
Well, many people believe that sort of the beginning of the end of the American Republic happened when the Intelligence Act was created there after World War II, and the CIA was created. Now, it did follow from a previous organization, the OSS, but still, it had more powers, and these intelligence agencies now have enormous budgets. There are many of these intelligence agencies, so the CIA is just one of, what, 11 major intelligence agencies. So you have several, each military branch has to have its own. And so when you talk about what percentage of the American budget goes to military affairs, you know, even the official budget, the official amount is very high. But you really need to factor in a lot of money that is not usually considered military spending. So if you factored in just the budgets for the intelligence agencies, it was an enormous amount. I don't have the exact figure, and nobody does. It's a secret, but people who are in the know speculate that it is a very, very high figure. Well, when you have that kind of money with no accountability, you have, you know, Lord Acton was certainly right. And, you know, he was a good Catholic. He was just carrying out the what the Christians have called the doctrine of original sin, which is really the doctrine of originating sin. When he said, and it's very important to get the exact words correctly, it's usually misquoted, but he said, power tends to corrupt. And absolute power corrupts absolutely. In the second one, no tends to. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. And we have a military and a set of intelligence agency now that have virtually absolute power. Thank you very much for coming out on this warm evening. And thank you. Thank you for a great event.